following authors. So there's Sheryl Shook, David Poland, Slava Richkov, David Simmons-Duffin, and Alessandro Vicchi. And more recently, just a paper with Sheryl Shook. And basically, this work refers to the derivation of bounds for three-dimensional CFTs. And this concerns the so-called extremal functional methods used for bootstrapping, for finding the spectrum of CFTs. So first, some very general, well, sorry, those are the outline. Some brief motivation. Then I'll discuss our results on CFT bounds. Then I will introduce our extremal functional method for finding the spectrum of a CFT. And how we apply that to the D equals 2 Ising law. So first, some very general remarks. We're interested in conformal field theories. There's many reasons why you could be interested in conformal field theories. One of them is that there are start and end points of renormalization group flows. So you expect scale invariance, but typically actually you also get conformal invariance, which is stronger than just scale invariance. And so they're like landmarks on the field theory landscape, or signposts. So you might think that this might be a good place to start if you want to understand the field theories themselves. And CFTs, they many times they're based in of attraction for many different field theories. So they correspond to universality classes, and so they have many applications from real physics, like water vapor transitions, second order phase transition, but also to N equals 4 Supreme Mills and the string theory. And perhaps more recently, in recent years, people have begun to understand that according to ADS-AFT, conformal field theories with a stress tensor are actually the same thing as quantum theories of gravity. So that's another very good reason for understanding conformal field theories. So conformal field theories, they have conformal symmetry, which I'll detail in a moment. But there are much stronger constraints than just Poincaré invariance. And so a hope that goes back to some time is that if you impose conformal symmetry plus unitarity plus possible some global constraints like modular invariance in two dimensions, this would actually fix CFTs almost uniquely. And so our long-term ambition is to use the constraints of conformal field theories to try to explore and characterize the space of these theories. So this is the idea of the bootstrap program, using conformal symmetry to try to, just using symmetry to fix the theory. And this program has been, to a large extent, been carried out successfully in two dimensions. So we have classification of minimal models, there's rational conformal field theories, and so on, and we can actually solve them. But well, you might argue that D equals 2 is special because in two dimensions, you actually have an infinite dimensional conformal group. They form the so-called Virasoro algebra. There are a finite number of Virasoro operators. So the situation, because of the larger symmetry, it's simpler. But now we want to attempt something similar in any dimension. And in any dimension, we won't have this infinite symmetry group. We only have the global conformal group. There will be, for instance, an infinite number of primaries of this group. So from the 2D perspective, they are usually called quasi-primaries. They are the operators which are annihilated by L1 in 2D. So the question, is this enough? Is this enough to actually solve for the CFTs? And for a long time, people didn't think it could. So let me remind you what conformal symmetry is. It's SOD plus 1, comma 1. You can split this into translations, rotations, dilatations, and these are so-called special conformal transformations. You can get them basically by doing a translation, inverting, doing another translation. Representations of this group, possible set is highest weight representations, where they're generated by so-called primary fields, which are annihilated by the special conformal generator. They're eigenvectors of the dilatation operator. And you form a representation of the conformal group by acting with with P on the primary field, so basically acting with derivatives. So these are the so-called descendant fields. So a whole set of these fields form the representation of the conformal group. So just by conformal symmetry, you can actually show that the two-point functions and the three-point functions of the theory are almost completely fixed. So the two-point function is completely fixed once I pick a normalization for the fields. So this indicates that you have to have the same field here in order to have a non-vanishing two-point function. And at the level of the three-point function, kinematically it's completely determined, and the only dynamical input is a single number, which depends on the three fields. And I should mention that this delta, the eigenvalue with respect to dilatations, is usually called the conformal dimension of the field. Okay, so far so good. The two-point functions and three-point functions, they're almost completely fixed just by conformal symmetry. Now let us look at the four-point function. So again, conformal symmetry imposes a set of kinematical constraints on the four-point function. And for instance, if you look, for instance, at the four-point function of a given field, let's call it sigma, I can write these constraints in this form. I know that the four-point function will take this form with some function of u and v are so-called cross ratios. So the dependence on the coordinates has to be via a function of this form. So these are kinematic constraints, but there are also dynamical constraints due to the existence of an operator product expansion. So the fact is that in a CFT, the OP is convergent. And so I can expand out the product of two fields in terms of other fields. So consider the case where these fields are two primaries, then I can write out their product as a sum of primaries and descendants. And the contribution of the descendants is completely fixed by conformal symmetry, and it's captured by this operator, this differential operator acting on the primary. So these functions, they're kinematically constrained, and you know what they are. You can find them. The only thing that you don't know is these coefficients, which are the three-point couplings. So if you take the three-point function with the primary, you precisely pick up this coefficient. So you see, because of the OPE, once you know the two-point functions, which, in other words, if you know the spectrum of the theory, and if you know the OPE coefficients, then basically you've completely solved the theory. Because beyond 3 points, all the correlators are fixed by the OPE expansion. So for instance, at the level of the four-point function, I can do the OPE in several channels. I can contract the field 1 and 2 and field 3 with 4, or I can do it in these other channels. And this gives me a decomposition of the four-point function. So this is the so-called 1-2 channel. This is the 1-4 channel. And so I have two possible ways. Well, there are three, but here I'm showing two. Two possible ways of writing out what the four-point function is. So schematically, what you're doing is that you're seeing that for every primary field appearing in the OPE, you get the contribution of that field plus all its descendants. The reason why the same field has to appear here on the left and on the right is because, if you recall, the two-point function was vanishing unless you had the same field. So the same field has to appear in the OPE of this and this, and so you get a contribution, which is these two coefficients, and then basically this object C squared, okay, acting on two-point function. So what is the idea of the conformal bootstrap? Well, this is a functional identity. And it's very non-trivial that this holds. Because the contribution of a state in a given channel, for instance, in this channel, has actually to be matched because of their asymptotic behavior. You can check that it's impossible to get this behavior in one channel unless you have an infinite number of operators in the other channel. Okay? So this match is highly non-trivial. It's not one-to-one. You need to consider an infinite set of operators to get just one operator on the other side. And so the existence of these two independent expansions poses constraints both on the spectrum of the theory and on the three-point couplings, which are the only data of the CFT. I told you, once you know these two things, you know everything. So the idea of the conformal bootstrap, then, is that these relations possibly apply to all possible correlators of the theory, completely determine both the spectrum and opening coefficients of the CFT. That's the dream, if you want. So let's see how you can start putting this dream in motion. So how can you use this equation to get some information? Well, okay, so what do we know? Let's consider the four-point function of a given scalar field, okay? We know that it takes this form, and we know the form of this function. We can write it in two different channels, either this one or this one. We know it's going to be some product of OPE coefficients, and then there's going to be the contribution of each primary. So recall that this thing is like the contribution of one of these lines, and it captures the contribution of the primary plus all its descendants. It's some function which is known because it's completely fixed by conformal symmetry. So I can write GUV in that channel or in this channel. So I have this equality. And so doing some rearrangements, I can write it in this form, and this in turn can be written like this. So this is my final equation. So lambda squared is simply, since all the fields are the same, these Fs are the same, I'm assuming unitarity. But at this point, I still don't need to assume unitarity. But okay, so there's some coefficient squared here. And this F is basically some difference of conformal blocks. It's something kinematic that we know. Okay, so this is the fundamental equation. This sum is equal to 1. The reason why I have this 1, basically, is because I separated out the contribution of the identity operator, which always appears in such a four-point function. Okay, so this is our equation. We're going to work with this equation. So supposedly this poses an infinite set of constraints on the spectrum because it's a functional equation. So how do you use them? First thing we're going to do is assume unitarity. Assume that the CFT is unitary, and this automatically places constraints on the spectrum of primary operators. In particular, the conformal dimensions for spin zero, they satisfy this bound, and for higher spin, they satisfy this bound. Okay, so not all possible vectors are allowed. Only those satisfying these constraints. And further, also because of unitarity, I can pick lambda O to be real, and this implies that lambda O squared is a positive number. And this is really the crucial thing. It's positivity. Okay, see it? Once you have positivity, we're going to derive everything else. So how do you do it? Well, so think of these functions as vectors. Okay? Then what we're doing here is that we're forming some positive linear combination of these vectors, and we're asking, does it contain the vector 1? Okay? So if you have a bunch of vectors, you're used to, if you just take linear combinations of a bunch of vectors, you get some vector space. But if you only take positive linear combinations, then you don't get a vector space, you get a cone. Okay? So you're asking, when is this vector, the vector 1, inside the cone generated by this function? Okay? Now, how do you solve these problems? It's almost linear algebra, right? Because it's just a bunch of linear equations, but there are constraints. There are inequalities. But the inequalities are linear. They're just demanding that these coefficients are larger than 0. And so actually, if we had a finite number, a finite dimensional vectors, I mean, as it stands, we have an infinite, continuously infinite amount of vectors, and they have continuous infinite components. If instead we had everything finite, then this would be a so-called linear programming problem, for which people have found efficient algorithms in the past. So this kind of problem can be solved. So what we're going to do is that we're going to discretize everything and put some cutoffs. Okay? So instead of taking a continuum of conformal dimensions, we're going to take some fine spacing, and we're going to place some large cutoff. I don't know. We're looking at the correlation function of a small dimension scalar. We can put the cutoff, I don't know, dimension equals 500 or something. And we can check that if you vary the scalar, this cutoff, nothing happens. So much for the finite number of vectors. But now we want to make the vectors finite dimensional. And to do this, what we're going to do is pick a particular basis for the functions. And this basis is basically Taylor expansion. Okay, it's a basis of derivatives. And we're also going to truncate the number of derivatives at some point, and we can also vary that to see how things change. So overall, our equation has become a linear equation. There's a sum of some vectors, okay, over some finite range, finite but large, with some positive coefficients, and I want it to be equal to this vector. Okay? And now we can use linear programming algorithms to solve this. So what are we actually going to do? Well, our approach will be initially to determine some bounds, okay, using this equation. So first thing you can do is, well, let's fix the dimension of sigma, the operator whose correlator we're examining. You fix that, and now you ask, well, we know that if I take the OPE of sigma with sigma, I always get the identity vector, and then I'm supposed to get a scalar, and you can ask, what is the maximum allowed value for the dimension of that scalar? Okay? So we're going to take that sum I wrote down before, and I'm going to impose some constraints in that I only allow scalar operators which have a conformal dimension above a certain number. But all other vectors, for higher spin vectors, I allow everything consistent with unitarity. So I'm looking at the most general thing apart from the fact that there's this gap in the scalar spectrum. Okay? So we're imposing a gap, and now what we're going to do is we're going to vary that gap, increase it, slowly increase it, until we find that there's no solution to this equation. Okay? So the way you can picture this is that these vectors, they form a cone, and the shape of the cone is changing as I vary this gap. Okay? So at the beginning, the identity vector lies inside the cone, but now I start changing the shape of the cone because I'm removing some vectors. So one of the vectors is doing this, and at some point, the identity vector now is outside the cone. So there's no more solution. Okay? So let us see this in practice, where we can visualize everything. The first non-trivial case is simply where we only consider up to two derivatives of the function. We consider three-dimensional vectors. Okay? So we've gone down from infinite, from functional equations to a set of three equations. So you might think this is too drastic. But okay, so let us start. First thing that we can do is that we can just redefine what these coefficients are to take care of the first equation. So we absorb these factors into lambdas, and so the first equation becomes the sum of these coefficients is equal to 1. Okay? And now I have to solve the other two equations, which are two-dimensional equations, but now the coefficients are bounded by this. And if you form all linear combinations, positive linear combinations satisfying this, of a bunch of vectors, you no longer get a cone, you get the convex hull of these vectors. Okay? The convex hull is, if you have a bunch of points, it's like putting a rubber band around the points. So you have a bunch of vectors. The convex hull is, you put a rubber band around them. This is what you get. So you get a convex polyhedron. So if you started from a cone, it's like slicing the cone. If you slice a polyhedral cone, you get a polyhedron. Okay? So let's, instead of thinking about the cone, we're going to think about this polyhedron because, well, it's two dimensions, it's easier to visualize. So now the question becomes, when is the origin contained in the convex hull of these vectors? Okay? When is it inside the polyhedron? So let's do this. So here's a plot of the vectors, these two component vectors. And I've plotted all the vectors with spin 0. So these lines are made by plotting the vectors for each value of the conformal dimension and the given spin. So there's a bunch of them. The grid is very finely spaced, so it looks like a curved line. There's spin 2, and there's higher spins as well, which are further above in the plot. So I have these vectors. This is the start point of the spin 2 line, and so on. This is some delta epsilon that I picked, and here's the origin. So let's form the convex hull, and this is what you get. So this is our polyhedron. Strictly speaking, it's not a polyhedron because one of the faces is curved, okay? And it's unbounded. But since we're discretizing everything, in practice, it becomes a polyhedron. Okay? So all possible linear combinations satisfying that constraint gives you all these possible vectors. And you see in particular that at this point, the origin is contained in the convex hull of the vectors. So at this precise moment, there is a solution to crossing symmetry. So now what do? We start increasing the gap on the, to the first scalar, delta epsilon. And so what we're going to do is move along this line. And we're saying there could be no vectors behind it. Okay? And you see that after a given point, so these vectors are excluded. At a given point, you see that the polyhedron no longer contains the origin. And so at this point, there is no more solution. Okay? So with this derivative example, you see that there are certainly, it's certainly possible to derive bounds. Okay? So this is one way in which you can do it. Now I want to mention a more productive approach, which easily generalizes more easily to higher dimensions, to higher number of derivatives. So notice, here there's a solution to crossing, and here there's no solution. And one of the differences is that in this plot, I can find a line which separates the origin from all the other vectors. Okay? Such a line is nothing but a linear functional. Okay? If I was in the cone, if I go back to the cone, basically what you have is that there's the cone, there's the identity vector, and I found a plane which separates one from the other. Clearly, if I can find such a plane, then there could be no solution to crossing. Because if I form positive linear combinations, I can never go to the other side of the hyperplane. So this is going to be our method. So you expand out to some ordering derivatives, you have some finite dimensional vectors, you fix the dimension of sigma, and you vary delta epsilon, the gap to the first scalar. And to prove that this equation has no solutions, what we're going to do is to find the linear functional, phi, such that when you dot it with all possible vectors, it's always positive. So it means that all the vectors are to one side of the linear functional, except the identity. The identity is going to be on the other side. So it's positive on every one except the identity. Clearly, this equation cannot be satisfied if this is true, because these coefficients are positive. So if phi of these vectors, it's always positive, when you add them up with positive coefficients, it will still be positive. Okay? So geometrically, it's just what I just described. If you can find a functional, then no solution to crossing exists. Okay? So here's some results. So you take this huge set of equations, you feed it to some linear programming solver, and you find, okay, when is there a functional or not? So in the white regions, you can find the functional. It means that no CFT can exist in this region. Below it, you cannot find the functional. So in principle, there are solutions. In fact, generically, you expect infinite solutions in this region. So this is the dimension of sigma, the dimension of the field whose correlator you're examining. This is the dimension of the first scalar. And you see, okay, there's an upper bound. And the interesting thing is that this upper bound curve has interesting features. One of the features of which is that there are kinks. In two dimensions, you see a kink. And in three dimensions, you also see a kink, although it's less clear. And further, so if you look at the minimum models in two dimensions, and you see where they lie along this plot, well, the 2D Ising model precisely lies at this kink to extremely high accuracy. And the other minimum models, well, it's not clear if they actually lie on the line, but they're certainly very close. And so M54, it's the tricritical Ising model. These are other ones. Okay? So let me just zoom in on the 3D case. So in the 3D, the kink also seems to lie on the 3D Ising model. And what's interesting is that there's very little that is known about the 3D Ising model. It hasn't been solved, of course. So if you do a close-up, so that little box there, this is our bound, and these are the known error bars on the 3D Ising model. So our bounds actually exclude a bit of those error bars.
But it looks like it's not quite on the kink.
Yes. The kink, both the sharpness of the kink and its position vary with the number of derivatives. This plot was made to some order in derivatives, so as you increase, it gets better. So. I mean, strictly speaking, we don't have a proof that this is a kink. Neither in this case nor in 2D. It looks like it. Okay, so much for bounds. I mean, there's many more things I could say. So with this technology, you can start playing. You can derive bounds on OPE coefficients. You can impose extra constraints like gaps to the next scale. You can deform these bounds. So there's many cute things you can do. But I want to talk about something which is maybe more interesting. extremal bootstrapping. So what's this? Basically, the way that the bounds were derived, it seems like you're throwing away a lot of information. Right? So you have all this hard work to compute this linear functional, but in the end, you're not even looking at it. You're just saying, does it exist or doesn't it exist? And you just throw out the information. So the question is there any useful information being carried by this functional, and can we put it to use? Well, so let us go back to our little two-derivative example. So here there are infinite solutions to crossing. There clearly are, because there are infinite positive linear combinations of vectors that I can form to obtain the origin. Okay? Here there are no solutions, but of course I missed the interesting bit, which is the critical case, where the origin is cutting across a face of the polyhedron. So just before it gets out. So the dashed line is the functional. At this point, it's getting trapped between the identity vector and the cone. Okay, there's the cone, so it gets squeezed between them. So, I mean, the answer, as you can guess, is that the solution is unique. So first of all, this functional, we call it the extremal functional, because if you were thinking in terms of this bound curve, I told you that everywhere above the bound curve, we can find a functional. This is the last functional that you can find, okay? So if the identity vector is here and the cone is here, there are many planes that I can pick. There are many possible functionals. But if the identity vector is lying against the cone, there's only one. It gets completely trapped. And generically, this is what happens. So we call this dashed line is the extremal functional. And now you see that the origin, in this case, is a unique linear combination of these two vectors. You cannot write it as a linear combination of any other vectors in this case. The solution is unique, because the moment that you add any other vectors, you're going to go inside the cone, and the identity vector is lying on the boundary. Okay? Further, so the origin is a linear combination of basically the vertices of this face. And since the hyperplane is lying against that face, all these vertices are zeros of the function, because they lie on the hyperplane. Okay, is this clear? So two conclusions. The only vectors that you need are the zeros of the extremal functional, and the solution is unique by convexity. So this is just a plot of the functional acting on all the vectors. And as you see,
I have a basic question. If you have a solution, why can't you rescale all the vectors by the same amount and get another solution?
Because the identity factor fixes the norm.
Ah, the norm is fixed by
yes. Yeah. It's the third equation that was missing from there. So let's plot the linear functional. So I'm just dotting the linear functional against all the possible vectors, and you see that it's always positive. So it means that all the vectors are to one side of the functional, but at some point it goes to zero, because it's touching the vector. Okay, so there are two zeros. These two zeros are the two black dots we saw before. And, one of them happens at the unitarity bound, so dimension 2 and spin 2, also known as the stress tensor. And in the scalar channel, you get 1.03 and 0. So spin 0. Okay? So now let's go back to the equations and let's solve them. all we have to do is to solve for the combination of zeros. There's only two of them that solves this equation. It's not trivial because there's only two vectors, but there are three equations. But again, one of them fixes the norm of the DOB coefficients. So this plot was derived fixing delta sigma is equal to 1/8, which is the dimension of the 2D Eisenmod. So that's an input. You always need to fix the dimension of the correlate. There's no getting around that. But so if you just, so you know what these vectors are, so you get dimension of epsilon is 1.03, and you can find the OPE coefficients. Okay, those lambda squares I was giving you before. Here I show lambda sigma sigma epsilon, and this is the central charge, which you can obtain if you know the OPE coefficient with the stress tensor. So this is what you get, and these are the true values. And you see that already with this extremely basic approximation, two derivatives, you're already getting things correct within 10% with a very basic approximation. So now we're just going to take this and include more derivatives. So what's the extremal functional method? You want to find a solution to these equations. How can you do it? One, so you fix delta sigma, you compute the bound, you find the last functional. The extremal linear functional. Then you take that functional and you determine the vectors which are zeros of that function. And then you just solve for the linear combination of those vectors, which gives the identity vector. The coefficients are the square of the OPE coefficients. That's it. So let's apply it to something. So recall, I showed you this curve, this 2D bound plot. So we could apply this anywhere along this bound plot. But of course, we want to apply it at a place where we already know the answer so that we have something to compare with. But what I want to emphasize is that we're not applying it to D equals to Ising because it's known or because it's easier, because it's in 2D. No, our methods, they work exactly the same. You could be in fractional dimensions if you want. You can be anywhere along the bound curve. The method works exactly the same.
So in the D equals 3 case, what would you use as the input for the dimension of sigma?
I'll get there to later. I mean, there is a known value, but it has an error bar.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'll discuss that later. So, let me remind you, there is only one single number that is going into our data. It's the dimension of sigma. Okay, a single number. So, here's the result now with 60 derivatives. And let's look at the functional. So this is the plot of the functional, again, the same thing I showed you before. So whenever you see it's logarithmic plot, so whenever you see a big dip, it means that's a zero of the function, okay? So these are the zeros at spin zero, the zeros at spin two. So here's the stress tensor, here's a dimension six, spin two. This is about dimension eight. Here there's a dimension one, dimension four, dimension eight. So you get all these zeros. So spin 4, you have this very beautiful plot. And basically, the more derivatives you add, the more dips you see. And they shift. So that's important, because not all of these zeros, you should trust them, because they haven't converged. We're always at some finite order in derivatives, so the results improve as you increase the number of derivatives. So you need to analyze that. So here it is. So let's see how the spectrum changes as I increase the number of derivatives. So you see, at the beginning, there's only one scalar, but at some point, there's a new guy that appears, and then it stabilizes. Then at another point, there's a new one that appears, it oscillates a bit, and eventually it converges. This is in the spin 2, and here you see that there's a bunch of operators which haven't converged yet, they're still jumping all over the place, and you might feel a bit funny about these big jumps. This is an artifact of the way that what we call M. It's the way in which the derivatives are organized. Basically, some derivatives are more important than others. So if you change your conventions, these jumps, they can be minimized. You still see them, but I mean, it's nothing deep. There's nothing deep about this. So here's some other plots. So it's spin 4, spin 6. You see them nicely converging. And they do converge, right? If you actually look at the numbers, you see that they're stabilizing extremely accurately. Now, how do you find the OPE coefficients? there is a slight hitch in that this polyhedron has some curved directions. So the most basic example is in two derivatives, you see that there is a curved direction. So if in this case, the origin was cutting across a face which has two vectors defining it. But if the origin was cutting across this face, there would only be one vector. The solution would still be unique by convexity. But there would be even less vectors. It would be a solution which is even more special. So numerically, this translates into bigger problems because you have a large number of equations, but you don't have enough coefficients to solve them all. Okay? So you cannot solve the solution exactly. It won't solve because of numerical error. So what we do is that we minimize. We find the zeros, and we're going to find the positive linear combination which minimizes this. So I mean, this is a bit of a technical remark. It doesn't pose any problems in principle, but the point is that even though the solution is unique in principle, because of numerical errors, there are small ambiguities, and you need to do it in this way instead of just solving for the linear combination directly. Okay? So some of the new derivatives that you're adding, they're not introducing new vertices. The polyhedron is along certain directions, instead of being flat, it's going to be curved. So when it's curved, you don't pick up any new zeros. Okay? So like if you had a cylinder, for instance, a cylinder. If you slice a cylinder through a hyperplane, so if you're just seeing it from the two-dimensional perspective, you see that the faces are lines, which are defined by 2 points. But now when you add the extra direction, you're still going to get 2 points at the bottom, okay? It's just a rotation of the line. Anyway, so we know how to compute the OP coefficients. I guess that's the upshot. So we can compute them, and we can also see how they're varying as the number of derivatives is varied, because we want to make sure that they have converged, that we should trust these numbers. So for instance, for the stress tensor, it converges pretty fast. Okay, so you see very little change. It's changing, but down at the 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5 level. So I should say that basically the range of these plots is the exact value, which is known, plus or minus 50%. So these plots give you an idea of how accurate the numbers are. Well, here, you just know it's good. You don't know how good. Here's a dimension 4 spin 0 guy. So it oscillates and it converges. Here's a dramatic example, spin 6, dimension 6, and at the beginning it's just all over the place, and then it stabilizes, converges. This is a dimension 8, spin 0, and notice that there's a lot less points, because this guy takes some time before it first shows up. This guy has been around for a long time, this guy only shows up at n equals 40. So it oscillates, but then it also seems to be converging. Basically what you want to do is, you want to see these little dots going to the middle of the plot, and that's what it's doing. So here's a summary. The low-lying spectrum. So these are the exact results of the 2D Ising, and these are the results we get with our method. So in particular, you see that indeed the 2D Ising model, it lies on the boundary to extremely high accuracy. It's supposed to be one. We can actually improve this. So these are results done with 60 derivatives, but now we can do it, I don't know, maybe 120 derivatives or something. So we can improve this maybe for another two or three orders of magnitude. So the OP coefficients, as you see, they're extremely good. So basically, I mean, you could say you're done. You have the low-lying spectrum. I'm not sure people would care about higher dimension operators, but we still get them.
So computationally, you said these were done just on an ordinary laptop.
On this laptop.
Yeah, right.
So it takes like, overall, everything from beginning to finish, it takes, I don't know, maybe 3 hours or something.
Yeah, so
it's extremely fast. I told you, even at two derivatives, which is extreme, you can do it, set it up in an hour on the computer, you get this very well, 10%. So. But I mean, I don't want to be over-enthusiastic. I always talk about limitations of the method afterwards. But so just a deeper summary. So what we get? We get the correct value for the dimension in OP coefficient of the first scalar, which many times is the only thing you're interested in, within 6 digits accuracy. Okay, both the dimension and the OP coefficient, 6 digits. The central charge, well, this is what we get, this is what it should be. And then we get 7, 10, 15, and 19 operators correct within 0.01, 0.1, so on. And there are operators which we get even better than this. But Our highest operation is dimension 15 in spin 14 with a 30% error on the OP coefficient. So now what we want to do is let's move on to something that we don't know. But there are problems. The problem is that here we don't know what delta sigma is. So there's two approaches. One is, okay, we don't know, so we'll find the spectrum within the error bars. We'll just try all possible values here and here, and we're going to get some error bars for every possible number. That's something you can do. Or if you're more optimistic, you can try to do better than what people have done, because in this case we're a bit lucky, because there's a kink. There was no features, there would be nothing we could do, but in this case there's a kink. So maybe if you increase the number of derivatives, this kink will become sharp enough that it starts to become competitive with the known error bars. Or maybe there'll be some other features. So for instance, something we can do is we can look at the spectrum at any point along this curve, right? And we can see what it's doing as we vary sigma. And we do see some funny behavior, both in the 2D case and the 3D case. We see operators switching positions and things like this. So maybe you can use that as a criterion to fix this dimension. And this is work in progress. I mean, we already have some preliminary results, but we really want to get things done properly. So let me just emphasize, I mean, for the 3D Ising model, this is the best that people have come up with. And I don't know how many years of calculations. So they have the dimensions of the four operators, no OP coefficients. So there's lots of room for improvement. So we can certainly get the OP coefficients already for all these operators within these errors. But we want to do more, so yeah, this is our goal. This is something we're working on now. Try to extract the spectrum and OP coefficients with this method. So outlook. Well, first of all, okay, some limitations. First limitation is that in all this story, it was essential that we had to lie on the boundary. So if you're not lucky, if your CFT doesn't lie on the boundary, in principle, you cannot know anything about it. But actually, you can. You need to add more information. So just knowing the dimension of sigma in this case is not enough. You have to give me some other input, which is perhaps not asking for too much. So if you tell me, for instance, well, the next operator will have dimension x, then I can feed it into my linear program. This will give me extra constraints. And what will happen is that this bound plot is going to become deformed. It's going to become changed. So there will be a new boundary. And now I can go to that boundary and solve for the spectrum. So that's the strategy. It's also something that we're trying to work out right now. So second limitation, well, you need some initial data. You need to know, I mean, I'm not sure if it's a limitation. You need to know something about the CFT that you want to find. If you don't know anything, then you can't get it. You could just solve for the spectrum everywhere, but thirdly, the method only finds a solution to crossing symmetry. Okay? It's not guaranteed, and in fact, I mean, it's almost for sure that it doesn't mean that there is a full consistent CFT with that spectrum and OP coefficients. Most likely thing is that it's not. Recall that we're only looking at a single correlator. So the next thing that you should do is compute your spectrum, and now let's look at the cross correlators involving operators that in that spectrum that you found. And things have to be consistent. If they're not, there is no solution. Okay? So that's another something that we're thinking of doing. Just look at the largest subsector of operators. And so having more correlation functions to look at and try to basically further reduce this bound plot. Okay? The technology is being refined. As I told you, there's lots of room for improvement. I did it on this machine, which is 4 years old. So you can do it on a cluster. There's lots of room for improvement. I think we can easily go to several dozen operators within 1%. We need to understand how to landscape the boundary so that we can pinpoint the CFTs that we want. Another interesting question is, why are there kinks? Why are there kinks? And for this, we just need to look at what is the spectrum doing. And the spectrum surely looks like it's doing something interesting. So then you can try to understand analytically what's happening. So I mean, this would be extremely exciting, of course, because the 3D Ising if you could have some analytical grasp on it, it would be amazing. You can also ask, well, what about the minimum models in 2D? We know that there are no vectors, so we should be able to see them decoupling in the spectrum. And we also have indication that this is true. Other neat thing, I mean, there's the list would go on and on, but you can try, for instance, reproduce the Wilson-Fisher line. Start off in 4D and just do these results in arbitrary dimension, which we can, and find the spectrum and check that they match the epsilon expansion. More exciting, including supersymmetry. Once you include supersymmetry, the bounds will become more constraining. And one of the major goals for us would be to bootstrap the spectrum of n equals 4. For this, you need basically to know the superconformal blocks with n equals 4 supersymmetry, but then the methods are directly applicable. Finally, just a few philosophical points. To me, it's amazing that just knowing a single number fixes, in principle, an infinite set of operators, dimensions, and OP coefficients. Okay? At the beginning, I told you that, well, the dream of the bootstrap is that looking at all the possible correlators, I'll be able to fix everything. Here, I'm only using a single correlator for the 2Dizing. You give me one number, and I give you everything else. I mean, it's amazing that the bootstrap is that strong. Secondly, we picked a certain functional basis in terms of some Taylor expansion coefficients, but there must be better ones. We don't have a good understanding why this is a good basis. It's just in practice, it seems to work very well. And maybe there's even, you can understand why these things work so well analytically. I don't know. It has to be explored. So maybe there's some geometry associated with the space of conformal blocks. I don't know. And I guess that's it. Yeah, thanks.